Good crowd and a full agenda. We'll try and move these things along apace to keep everybody on schedule. We've got floor at 10:15 this morning. Let's start with a public hearing on House Bill 3129. I'll open that. I see Representative Miller is here. Lizbeth is making her way to the desk. Lizbeth, if you could give us a brief overview while Representative Miller is collecting himself, and then we will be on our way.
Chairman Shadowley and committee members, for the record, I'm Lizbeth Martin-Mahar with Legislative Revenue Office. So you have before you House Bill 3129, and this does a variety of things, so I'll kind of start through systematically what the bill does. In the first couple sections there, it creates a new income and corporate excise tax credit for taxpayers who make voluntary charitable contributions. And it's going to limit that new credit to $100 for single or corporate returns, and $200 for joint returns. And it also restricts the personal income and corporate excise tax credit to no more than the taxpayer's tax liability. Part-year and non-resident taxpayers may claim the credit without proration. It begins then tax years after January 1st, 2004. So the other major component in this bill is it's sunsetting then several corporate excise and personal income tax credits as of January 1st, 2004. So Section 4 sunsets the Trust for Cultural Development. Section 5 sunsets the Political Contribution Credit. Section 6 sunsets the Farm Worker Housing Construction Credit. Section 7 sunsets the Farm Worker Housing Lender Credit. Sections 8 through 10 sunset the Pollution Control Credit. And it's basically for construction of pollution control facilities that must commence before December 31st, 2003. Then that construction has to be completed and applications have to be filed before January 31st of 2004. There's also an elimination of the Business Energy Facilities Credit. That's Section 13. The Advanced Telecommunication Facilities, that's Section 14. The Electronic Commerce Enterprise Zone Investments at Section 15, and the Sewer Connections, which already sunsets, or at least one subsection of it does, under current law in 1995, and that's Section 16 of the bill. Now, I'm not going to go through the various credits. You'll have a lot of testimony on that, but I just wanted to make it clear to you exactly what you have as far as an overall revenue impact. And you have a table where I've listed each one of the different credits that are eliminated versus the new charitable contribution credit, and I split it out between personal and corporate for the 03-05 biennium and the 05-07 biennium. And basically, the issue is this new charitable contribution credit is really broad as far as the charitable contribution deduction. Those individuals, those tax returns that use the charitable contribution deduction are the ones who could then be eligible for the charitable contribution income tax credit. So what you have are a large number of people that can use the charitable contribution credit. And in 2000, there were like 473,490 personal income tax returns which claimed this charitable contribution deduction, and there were 6,319 corporations that also claimed that charitable contribution deduction on the corporate excise tax returns. So you have a large base here, and that's why when you then have a $100 credit or $200 for joint returns, you have then a loss of a reduction in new from this new income tax credit of roughly $109 million in the 03-05 biennium and $164 million in the 05-07 biennium. And the reason why these are, you know, quite a bit larger in the 05-07 is because in 03-05 that is really just 1 year, tax year 2004. But the reductions that you see in the credits then from the you're eliminating these credits, so you will see an increase then in taxes. Well, that increase is not to the same magnitude as this new charitable contribution credit. So in 03-05 biennium, you're seeing an increase from the decrease in the elimination of those tax credits of $23 million and an increase then of $63 million in the 05-07 biennium. So the net overall revenue impact is a reduction in state revenues in the 03-05 biennium of $86 million and a reduction in the 05-07 biennium of $101.5 million. So that really, and the reason why basically with and I'm sure you'll hear testimony to this, but basically with, you cannot just eliminate some of these credits outright. It's going to take a few years. All you can eliminate are the new individuals that would come in after 2004. Right. So that's why it takes a while for these credits to be reduced.
All right. Thank you very much. Representative Miller, welcome to House Revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, State Representative Randy Miller of District 37. As you know, Mr. Chairman, I had the good fortune of chairing this Revenue Committee on the Senate side. And I thought that so many occasions you came into this room and there was just the staff and you went through some technical correction and you kind of got lonely. So I thought I would devise a bill that would produce a crowd for you, Mr. Chairman.
We had to clean up.
Yeah. And let me preface my remarks to my friends behind me are here to protect their particular niche in the tax code in the form of their credit. This bill was simply designed to achieve the opportunity that would empower Oregonians to give to charities of their choice as opposed to those simply listed due to the effect of certain special interests who were able to achieve that place in the tax code. This is not a shot at their particular operation, their good purposes. As a matter of fact, those who take advantage of this credit could give to many of the interests represented in this room. So as we do approach the date that many people will be filing their taxes, they are looking for sometimes ways that they can give to charitable causes that will have an impact on their tax statement. And it has occurred to me, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee over the years, that we should, I think, give added flexibility to citizens to direct dollars in a way that they think would best assist Oregon. So the concept that I've certainly thought about for a number of years has been what I would want to call the Oregon credit. And again, the whole purpose of that would be to allow a taxpayer to say, you know, I think that particular charitable organization, even that political cause, that cultural idea, whatever it might be, I'd like to direct some funds to them among taxes I would otherwise owe the state of Oregon up to a particular amount, $100 in this case, as we started out rather timid, to try to make it, again, affordable. And as the co-chair of Ways and Means, I'm a little sensitive to things that would have a negative impact on our budget. But I think it's, to me, the right way to go. And the reason you have a long list of those who are on this in that wonderful book you've all memorized now, the tax expenditure report and the credits, is simply to try to make it be a little bit more affordable. Again, it's not a direct shot at the good work and the reason for the credits were established in this book, but it was simply, let's, again, make this affordable. And in order to do that, some credits need to be looked at in terms of whether or not they are sustained. Some credits, as you know, Mr. Chairman, perhaps should be massaged for the next biennium or two. I know that Representative Hass has had interest in reviewing the credits, and I personally think that's entirely appropriate. We currently, I believe, have $27 billion in tax breaks through deductions, credits, and other methods in our tax laws. And whatever you do with this bill, just the examination of that potential revenue at this particular time, I think, would be worthy of your pursuit. I want to also say that in terms of scoring this bill and its impact on our budget, it's kind of like, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, you know that whenever we have some kind of tax proposal, we have the argument between the static and the dynamic approach. It seems to me that we shouldn't just assume this is a negative, because giving to charitable organizations, in my personal opinion, I think has a positive impact, because many of those organizations that people donate to do good work that probably creates savings and creates assistance for Oregonians that we would otherwise have to fund. And what I see in this bill, and what I'm sure would happen, is that many Oregonians, and probably more Oregonians, would be inspired to contribute to charitable causes. Frankly, I think that's a good thing. And to the extent you have a credit, I don't think it would take any phenomenal thought process by either a phone solicitor or someone representing a school foundation, whatever it might be, to say, you know, you got that $100 Oregon credit. Tell you what, why don't you give me $200 and half of it's free? And I think schools and other folks who could use some assistance, I think, would really like this particular credit. As you go through this credit, this idea, I would focus on at least a couple of credits that, in my judgment, cannot be sustained in their current form. And one of them I hope to come back and visit with this committee about, and that is the political tax credit, which is about $8.9 million in a biennium. In this particular biennium, in fact, and I've rooted for this before, as you know, Mr. Chair, we should remove that from the tax code in any event. It is pretty pathetic to think that people need that crutch to invest in their favorite political cause. Frankly, I'm ashamed that we've put that in as a credit as opposed to perhaps a deduction. But given our financial situation, I don't think that should continue to stay in this tax code. Removing that alone, of course, will not make this particular concept totally affordable. The other one I would suggest you review while you're going through these is the cultural trust credit at $500 an individual. Frankly, that's well beyond what we can and should afford. And the point of this is that, you know, these contributions can continue. It's just that they won't have all of the crutch of the tax credit to go with them. No one here is speaking on behalf of giving to a political cause or candidate. No one is here speaking on behalf of saying don't give to any cultural activity. As a matter of fact, through the Oregon credit, you certainly could. And you'd get $100 worth of credit for so doing, because it would be a qualifying charity. So, with that, Mr. Chairman, that's the essence of the bill. I leave to this extremely talented committee the details of making it balance. But that's what I'm about today.
Thank you very much. Questions for Representative Miller? You mentioned the $200, you get $100 credit, and I guess, Elizabeth, just a question of technical under the bill. I see there's an addition to Oregon income if you claim a federal deduction for the same contribution. If you contribute, though, an amount over the credit, do you get the deduction would remain in place? Is that right for that extra $100? Let's say,
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. All you would do is that first $100
yeah.
would not be be able to be claimed as a deduction.
Right.
You'd add that back.
This is not in lieu of the
credible
deduction.
Not in
though.
Lieu
it's
of
just,
it.
Okay.
Correct.
After that first $100. All right. Other questions for Representative Miller? All right. Thank you for coming down this morning.
Thank you, members. I appreciate your consideration.
Next, we've got a list here. If I can encourage folks to be brief again, we've got a pretty full agenda here this morning and floor session at 10:15 that we need to get to. But let's start with Joe Schweinhardt and John Ledger, if you want to come on up together.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm John Ledger with Associated Oregon Industries, and I'm going to be very brief here because we had a long and convoluted discussion, some of you will recall, on pollution control tax credits, probably more than you ever wanted to know, about 2 weeks ago. I just wanted to mention, though, very quickly, just some things to keep in mind when you look at these credits, and this certainly applies to pollution control tax credit. These credits were built to do something specifically, and the pollution control tax credit is a credit you get, as you recall, against income for doing pollution control activities. You don't get the credit until you hire people, build something, and then file. If you don't make any money, you can't use the credit. But the credit's only there if you build something and you hire people to build it. It used to be we had very low power rates in this area. That was something that attracted businesses. That's one of the reasons we have a lot of high-tech companies. That's gone. And this is one of the few things we have left to really keep industries here. The credit is extended over 10 years, so if you get a credit and the program is cut off, the immediate fiscal impact is relatively small because you have to wait for 10 years of tail to run through. And I would just end up by saying that we do have a bill in that revamps this program a little bit. The program was re-upped last regular session, went through both houses with a total of 8 no votes. So it was supported by the governor. And this is one of the bills we have in place that, you know, frankly, as I've said many times, if a company is looking at closing a plant or closing a mill, sending people home without a job, we would prefer that they do that in Georgia or Minnesota than Oregon. And that's what this program does. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Seeing none, Joe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Joe Schweinhart, Associated Oregon Industries. Before I start my testimony, one thing I'd like to say, and I try to bring the committee up to date on our employment economic situation. Sony today announced, it was in the paper today, and Springfield announced that they were laying off about 300 people. I think yesterday or the day before, paper in Medford, Roseburg Lumber, laying off about 300 people. And we're about 2 points higher on unemployment than the U.S. average. Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, I'm here today in opposition to House Bill 3129. There is more than one aspect of this bill that I disagree with today, but I want to discuss the advantages of the business energy tax credit, a credit that this bill eliminates. Since 1980, there have been 6,500 energy tax credits have been awarded to businesses. They include grocery stores, pulp and paper plants, farms, ranches, high-tech factories, office buildings, and food processors throughout Oregon. Most of the money was spent on efficiency and renewable resources that stay in Oregon, going to vendors that sell and install equipment and the manufacturers who build it that are located here. The tax credit program is influencing the way Oregon business responds to the recent and ever-increasing energy cost. In each of the last 2 years, according to the Department of Energy figures, the Oregon Department of Energy figures, businesses made nearly $100 million in investments to cut energy costs, more than double the amount in prior years. Why would you want to end this program? These technologies make all Oregonians less vulnerable to supply shortages and rising energy rates. Energy tax credits save businesses and schools from the high cost of operation during our current recession, allowing them to change the way they operate to save energy and to save cost in the future. Why would you want to end this program? The energy tax credit is cost effective. The Oregon Department of Energy numbers indicate that for every dollar invested in energy projects, Oregonians gain about $2. Why would you want to end this program? Let me say more about the economic development. Energy tax credit helps companies stay in business and avoid layoffs. Businesses can receive a credit of up to 35% over 5 years. An example of this is the Sierra Pine Company in Medford. They were able to remain open 24/7 during the recent price spikes in energy costs. The investment they made in energy-efficient cogeneration equipment that they could not have purchased alone was the reason. A tax energy credit also influenced the expansion of the Tillamook Dairy in Boardman. A recent study by the Oregon Office of Energy showed that for each average megawatt of energy saved, the state experiences an increase in annual economic output, wages, and jobs. That office also estimates that for projects installed recently as 2002, Oregon's annual economic input increased by $14.4 million. Annual wages by $4.4 million, and annual business income by over $900,000. You do not want to eliminate this program. Since the beginning of this program, small businesses with projects under $20,000 have had almost 5,000 applications approved, accounting for over 75% of all projects. We all know that small business is the backbone of our economy and that they are operating on a small margin of profit. In the 2001 session, you enabled schools and nonprofit agencies to use the program by finding a business partner to pass through the value of the tax credit. In 14 months, 30 applicants, mainly schools and nonprofit agencies, have completed more than $1.1 million in pass-through projects. This is a very successful and necessary tax credit. It helps businesses, nonprofits, such as schools, and our economy as a whole. as well as our environment. At a time when our economy is in a recession, at a time when you are searching for ways to lessen energy costs and ways to increase jobs, why would you want to eliminate this program? Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today and be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you very much. I think what I'd like to do, though, I want to apologize for not seeing Representative Merkley back there in the crowd. I think I'll do is recess this hearing right now and ask you folks to step back, if you would. Thank you for your testimony this morning. And I will recess briefly the public hearing on House Bill 3129 and open the public hearing on H.J.R. 43. Do we have a sign-up sheet on that? I tell you what, never mind, Kathy. We'll come back to it. We'll just take Representative Merkley and Senator Harper now anyway. Steve, if you could give us the staff overview on this while we invite... No. You're here. We're here. We've got nowhere else to go. Nothing else to do.
I hate it when you talk like that.
Steve. Mr. Chair, members, House Joint Resolution 43 is a constitutional amendment that deals with an appropriation to the state school fund that would be voted on at the May 4th primary election in 2004. What it does is to set up what a minimum amount should be from the state, from the general fund to the state school fund in beginning in 05-06. For those 4 years, the amount would be based upon either the percent of the general fund appropriated in 01-02 or a dollar amount per minimum dollar amount per student.
I don't like this. I like the other.
And then beginning in 2009-10, it makes the same conditions for the minimum dollar amount from the general fund, but it's based upon the dollar amounts in the year that's 4 years prior to the year that's being appropriated for. It would also allow the legislature to make an appropriation below those minimum amounts if it was by three-fifths votes of both assemblies.
Except we've just been handed dash one amendments that appear to replace the bill.
Oh, I have not seen those.
So.
Yeah, Jeff. Yeah.
Yeah, I have neither. They're dated today. So they must be very fresh. Let me turn it over to you gentlemen. Senator Harper, yeah. Representative Merkley, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, a chance to testify on this particular idea. The basic concept, which is really what I'm here to speak to rather than the particulars in either the original bill or the amendment, is to place a floor under Oregon's school funding to provide for an index. In this case, the year is 2001-2002, and say that at a minimum in the future, we will fund our schools in Oregon at this per student level, inflation adjusted, unless the legislature votes to decrease it. And this has in both the original measure and the substitute, a three-fifths majority required to reduce it below that level. This concept stems out of conversations about the issue of stability. Often we speculate on how it is that everyone campaigns on stable and adequate funding, but it's so hard to create a structure that addresses the issue of stability. So this is a statement that would go into the Constitution, a provision that would essentially say to future generations, we're going to be there for our schools at least this floor level, unless there are circumstances in which the legislature decides to lower it. But it would take a significant effort of the legislature to do so. There is a very similar proposal that was passed in 1988 in California. It was Proposition 98. It had a very complex set of triggers, three different triggers, and during the years that it has been in place, which be now 15 years, there are four times that the state has faced fiscal problems such that this floor came in handy to help ensure that schools would be sustained through good times and bad times. That is the general provision. I've handed out a briefing on this, and essentially addressing first the need, there are three main reasons for this concept. One is simply that our children do need to have a good education to compete in a global economy. The second is from an economic point of view. We have heard rumblings from the business community that it's going to be hard to recruit top talent to come to Oregon if they can't count on the schools being there, the public schools, for their employees to send their children to. This is a large factor in the quality of life and in recruiting business. So in the short term, in kind of a five-year perspective, having a commitment to stable schools is important to be able to recruit companies to either expand in Oregon or to grow in Oregon. This was an issue I discovered when I went back to a conference in January in Washington, D.C., and had numerous people come up to me and say, what is going on with Oregon schools? And I was surprised to find that they'd been reading about the Oregon economy and the Oregon challenges on the front pages of the Wall Street Journal and in Newsweek and in a variety of other articles that have circulated. Somebody handed me one last week from the Washington Post. Then in February, we had the situation where Gary Trudeau ran a series of cartoons about education in Oregon, and that has greatly accentuated the visibility that we've gained in terms of our challenge in funding our schools. I'm going to attach those to this briefing. Then in terms of the 50-year view, we are an economy now, global economy, where both basic resources and finished products move very, very easily from place to place at little effort and little expense. And the result is that we are going to be seeing an economy, and we're already well en route to it, where the places that prosper are the places that have a high level of commitment to education. They're going to be those pockets around the world, and other places are going to be left with the low-cost manufacturing jobs that can be done virtually anywhere with the final product shipped where it needs to go. With that 50-year view, I feel like we have to have a ferocious commitment to education, and considering an idea like this might be part of the way that we express that and the way we make it happen. Then in terms of equity, if we've talked about a variety of ideas for funding education, including expanding the local option. My concern is that if we expand the local option without any sort of base, that we'll see exacerbation of the discrepancy between rich and poor districts, and that is not a healthy thing for the state, for the kids of the state, or for thinking of ourselves as a community knitted together. There are really three things that might fit very nicely together into a package. And as I've talked to folks, they said, well, wouldn't this other strategy be better? And have brought up some of the ideas that have been discussed. And I think that there are three things that actually, it isn't an either or, it's the possibility of a package that includes all three. One is that one can have a floor, as I'm suggesting here. A second is, if you have a floor, it's much more comfortable to have some sort of expansion in a local option. And third, if there is the possibility of bringing additional revenues to the overall picture, be it through the packages that have been discussed in this committee or will yet be discussed in the weeks to come, that too would be a wonderful thing. And in fact, the third point addresses one of the things that is difficult for me as an advocate of human services. My concern is that in any given year, the pie is only so large. And if you allocate a set amount to education, you reduce the amount that may be available to public safety or to human services. And you have the ongoing tension that exists even today in that situation. But my belief is, and what has made me comfortable in putting together this proposal for conversation, is that unless we are passionately committed to education over the generation to come, the pie is going to shrink and everything will be hurt, not just our schools, but our human services and our public safety and everything else that we hold dear in our hearts here in quality of life in the state of Oregon. The basic provisions in this, one, it's a constitutional mandate.
Second, it covers all the funds that are counted against the state school funding formula, including the local revenues that count against that formula. That was left out of the first version, and it was placed into the second. The third is that it provides for a trigger based upon the per student funding in 2001-2002. We had a provision in the first one, which is not in the second one, and I think Senator Harper may have a preference for that. I'm sorry we didn't together on this before, but the point, and that was a share of the state's budget. A third issue or idea that has been raised in holding conversations within the education community is an index based upon the concept of total personal income in the state of Oregon. And my point here isn't that one is right and the others are wrong. It's that if the concept of a floor holds value, it'd be worth pursuing a study of what worked and didn't work in Proposition 98 in California or other similar measures around the country, what triggers make sense or don't make sense, whether it makes sense to have 3/5 vote to lower it or 2/3 as it is in California or perhaps 50% as it might be elsewhere. My goal is to not say any one of these features is the absolute right angle, but the general philosophy, the general idea of a floor under education spending is something that merits serious consideration. I've enclosed a chart, state school funding per ADMR, and the top chart is the one I'd like to direct your attention to. You can see that in an inflation-adjusted basis, spending was about the same in 3 years, 1999-2000, 2000-2001, 2001-2002, and then it dropped considerably in 2002-2003, as we all know, and suffered through the challenges of this past year. So really, it wouldn't matter whether an index was based on 1 year or the other in terms of those 3 years, but those 3 years are very consistent, and that would be a reasonable floor, at least a place to start the discussion. So that's what I've come to share, and I'll turn this over to my colleague.
All right. Senator, welcome to House Revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Harper, State Senator from District 28. You know, a Harper-Merkley bill, I'm sure, has most of you just squirming in your seats.
I meant to schedule this for Tuesday.
Yeah.
first, but... I missed it.
That would have been better. The issue, and I appreciate Jeff bringing this to me, I feel one of my core values that I try and work on is the school funding issue. Stable school funding issue as it relates to the overall economy, but the stabilization or the basic financing, to me, this fits one of those value systems. We build a floor. I come my in-laws are both school teachers in California, and they first brought me this idea, you know, when they first became my in-laws 3 or 4 years ago, about a percent of the general fund, which is the area that I really believe strongly in, if we can institutionalize that. But this, to me, is a step in that direction. A stable school funding, i.e. a floor, that way we could go back to our school superintendents on the 1st of January and say, it's going to be this, and based upon the economy, it's going, you know, we can add to it. So we can have an add-back list, if you will. I think the part of the discussion from the system is going to be, well, if we have this becomes the ceiling, and I think we just need to work through that if we can. But if you couple this floor, if you will, Mr. Chair, with the idea of a local option, I think that becomes a package that we should really consider, more of a package concept, because the local option based upon a floor, a moving average. Now, how you get that moving average, Jeff has an idea. I think his original version is a good idea, but how we have that moving average that goes up with time is the concept that I'd like to pursue. So we have a floor, we have a local option, and we've given the school districts some certainty, you know, to the 80th and 90th percentile of where they're going to be year after year after year. And I think it would be an important element. It'd be an important element to me if I were the school administrator or if I were the third grade teacher in the classroom, I think that's something that we ought to take a look at and ought to pursue. And that's why I'm happy to be here, happy to participate in this. I think it's an important concept, and I'd like us to, as a legislature, kind of take a look at it and kind of work with it and see if we can't make something that fits. But that's what it is.
Thank you very much. Questions for either Representative Foss?
Thank you. Representative Merkley, you touched on the point of one of my concerns. I mean, I think this is a good idea and a good concept, but your concern is my concern. What about the shrinking pie of human services, not to mention community colleges and higher education that would not be part of it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hess. I really struggled with this notion because when you look at it in any given year, such as right now, we're looking at our existing tax structure, our existing resources, and how do we allocate it. And as long as we're looking at the issue right in front of us, that is the dominant question. You're dividing a fixed pie. But I feel if we're looking down the road, then, and this wouldn't be, if this was to go out to voters next year, it wouldn't be in place until 2005, 2006, so it starts a bit down the road, that you are now asking the question, how do we build a healthy society that not only will be a minimum floor for education, but will have the resources to be able to support the other programs we hold dear? And when I place it into that context, I feel like the world we're in now, education is so critical. Oceans are no longer protecting our society. The flow of information with the Internet is no longer protecting our society from kind of the ruthless competition of the low-cost markets around the world. And thus, we have to go through the process of a shift in thinking where we come to realize that if we are not aggressive on the education front, we will lose on all fronts.
Senator Herbert?
I think we see this biennium, 01, 03, 05, 07, we see the reason that a floor is a legitimate approach to life and in one of our core functions of the state. The chair and the committee put together a savings account, a brilliant concept and one that's going to save our bacon in years to come, maybe even this year. But what I would do, Mark, is I would have that savings account fills in the gaps when we have a disaster that we're in a recession now, quite frankly. You know, people don't have the money, we don't have the money. So that savings account makes this viable, makes this doable, because that would fill it up to at least this minimum level for these disaster years. And that's how you get through the rough times. That's what I'd suggest is how this thing would work. And when we're having rough times, we're having rough times all around the board. But if I could go back to my schools and say it's going to be at this dollar level, and this is how we'll get there no matter what, that to me is an important element in planning and operating the system. So,
okay, Representative Virgin,
Senator Harper, Representative Merkley, thank you. I am so happy to see the conversation about stable school funding coming before us to talk about the different ways. This is a unique idea. It's very interesting to me. I have two comments. I wonder if you'd comment on yourself, and that is the expansion by local option and how that impacts the equity. In other words, schools that are rich districts and poor districts. And the other is that my email to me reflects that voters are saying to me as a legislator, you do something. Don't keep punting back to the public to vote. And I know this is a constitutional amendment, but I just want to think about, is there a way that your concept can work in, that the legislature itself can have the courage to stand up and say, this is the kind of priority that we put on education?
Representative Verger, if I could, Jeff, my email says, you guys quit doing stuff to us. So...
And we don't live that far from you.
Yeah. To be fair, the local option, and I want to take on the local option thing because it's it's a Paisley, Oregon, it's a Burns, Oregon issue about the inequities that may arise. It's not necessarily a Hillsborough or Washington County or whatever. If you have a local option, that's why I think this moving average. I would put my constituents against your constituents, and I think they both equally are passionate about it. There is a real, we don't have that many buildings, and those trees aren't that many that we can cut, but our ability to raise funds is a little bit less. Representative Hossam has the same issues. But if we have a floor that rises, I say this moving average concept that rises, that evens it out, and that makes me comfortable with coming before you today. That makes me comfortable that I can go home to Paisley and say, this is what we tried to do. This is why we tried to do it. If you can't raise as much money as Beaverton, then that's an issue, but that's not an overarching issue that's going to kill the whole deal to me. It will be equal, but we'll be equal at the, at some level, a little bit less than 100%. And I think that's worth pursuing. I can take that back to rural Oregon and look them in the eye and try and sell this. That's why I think it's an issue. The other issue, of which to me is the bigger problem, is since Measure 5, the local schools have lost, and it's really not bad. It's not because they're bad people. They've lost the ability to really control expenses. If they have a little say with the local option, a little say in the revenue raise, then my hope is human nature will provide them a little more impetus to help control expenses, to get this money all the way back down to the kids, a little more so than they have the incentive to do now. And that's why I believe the local option is a legitimate way of taking a look at that aspect of life. Rural Oregon may or may not be 100% equitable, but they won't be 50 or 60%, which is where they were 10, 15 years ago. So that's why I think this is a workable solution. Nothing's perfect, but I think it's workable.
If I can follow up on that, equity is not just a rural issue. It's certainly an issue to one of my high schools, and the superintendent is here to testify on this, the bill, Barbara Rommel. But it does not have a very large tax base for property taxes, and whereas adjoining districts have much higher bases, so they have to tax themselves at a much higher rate in order to provide any given amount of help per student, much like some other districts in rural Oregon. And we discussed and raised the idea of equity grants as something that can help compensate for fairness, but still it's awfully hard in a property tax-based poor area or anywhere where the economy, even if it's based on payroll, if the payroll is not that large, it's very hard to raise the funds locally to have equally good schools. So that comes, I think that if we're going to have an enhanced local option, I'd sure be a lot more comfortable if there's going to be a floor, and I'd also be a lot more comfortable if the equity grant concept was continued. On this issue of punting to voters, one of the things that I found as I wrestled with why it's so hard to get your hands around stable school funding is there is no accountability in this building. When a bill comes from Ways and Means to the floor to support schools, no matter how you vote, it's a pro-education vote. I can vote for it saying that it was the best deal, even if it was a crummy deal, and I can tell my constituents it's the best deal. I can vote against it and say I was holding out for something better. Whether I vote yes or no when that comes to the floor, I go home with a pro-education position. And one of the factors in this bill is it says if you vote to lower funding below the floor that's in the Constitution, now you're held accountable because it's accountable in the sense that your vote is very clear. You now know that a yes vote lowered funding below the floor and a no vote protected the floor if a proposal came out to lower it below the floor. So you have the ability for voters to translate a yes and no vote into where you really stood on different education proposals. I might add, if we had the ability to have floor amendments on an education bill, that also might create that sort of dialogue, but that's not within our existing...
Yeah. He wants his name off the bill.
I'm out of here. So
we hid that somewhere in the bill there. It says floor amendments will be allowed.
Okay.
Representative Hobson, your name is on here, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to follow up on something that Senator Harper mentioned in regard to possibly having it seen as a ceiling. We spent a lot of time and energy involving business community and educators on doing the quality ed model, which I think is a lofty goal, but one that was determined to be necessary. With that in mind, could you elaborate a little bit more on how we can be sure that this floor, if you will, isn't seen as the ceiling?
Well, I, Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, there is no guarantee of anything. To me, this is the first step. In my perfect world, my bill has 45 to 50% of the general fund is K through 12 state school fund, and that is the amount that they get year after year. And we make up if there's a hole in bad years. That would be the direction that I am most comfortable with. But this is a good first step. No, there is no guarantee. There is no guarantee based upon the economy. But I think if we have the local option, we have a floor. That's today's version of stability. That is today's definition of basic education, if you will. That's just one way to define it fiscally, but.
The mantra we hear, is stable and adequate, and
they're
not
mean?
Necessarily the same thing. I mean, stability is one thing; it's a good in itself. I would say an adequate is a discussion that you can have on an ongoing basis. This provides at least the element of stability if we go this route.
Yeah, and we will. And the other element about school financing, that's a different discussion. That's another discussion, but. These to me are kind of the building blocks. This is kind of the first tier, if you will. If you'd like to go further, fine. If you'd like to stop here, I think that would be fine. But this would allow us, where I come from, to at least put out a school budget with some certainty year after year. And we wouldn't have, hopefully, the sine wave that we put them through. You know, we gave those guys a school budget, 30 June of last year. That's not right. You know that's not right. You used to do this for a living. We shouldn't do that to our people.
I agree. Thank you.
All right. One thing I'd have, and then we'll let you go and finish our other work, but Senator Harper, you mentioned, I think it's a good point, using the stability fund as a gap filler, basically, mm-hmm. on those downturns. I think that would take an amendment, because as it is right now, mm-hmm. as I see the looking at the dash ones, this floor is a general fund that, when combined with local revenues, is equal to the formula of the prior year adjusted. That tells me that doesn't take into account the use of the stability fund, because that would be money other than general fund. So that I think this would require a general fund continuum tied to local revenues and doesn't take into account those years when general fund might dip, and you're using the stability fund to fill that gap. So somehow we'd have to take into account the stability fund as a gap filler in that formula to maintain that target floor.
Yeah, I just read that as we just go do it. I didn't.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is this: the general fund would still have to do it, and the stability fund would actually be on top of that. And I think that's probably more than what you had in mind. Mm-hmm. The other one is just for thought, and we can chew this. But this refers to again in the formula based on student attendance. Did you have in mind? I mean, we got ADMW, we got ADMR, we got ADMR extended. Or ADMW expanded. You got, what is it, first day of fall enrollment. You've got all sorts of measures of attendance.
Yes.
Do we need to be more specific as to how we're going to measure that attendance, or is that something we just leave to legislation if we're going to do this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The conversations we've had in thinking this through have been about ADMR rather than ADMW. Whether we need to be more specific is a good question we need to pursue with our legal lawyers.
Because I think what we saw in the Eco Northwest study anyway is, depending on which measure you use, you can come up with dollar figures that are 100% higher than.
Right.
And so that there is a big range just in how you choose membership or attendance.
The idea of using ADMR is to have a crisp measure, because ADMW, if we change the weights, if we double the weights for English as a second language, we greatly increase the factor. Also, it's one reason that utilizing, instead of using a percent of the quality education model, utilizing an index based on actual funding from a given year is in this particular piece, because that helps create a very crisp measure against which to judge what needs to be done.
Okay. And one last question I might have is, we can take a look at this again. Just so we know, if this had been enacted 5 years ago, what would that general fund obligation be for the coming 2002-03 school year?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the factors that goes into that is an estimate of how student population will increase and of what inflation will be over that two-year period.
We can take a look at, we can get a sense of how this might work in the future if we look, if we start the clock 5 years ago.
Where's Warner? Hey.
Yeah. Okay. I'd like to see that anyway, because that might tell us. Mm-hmm.
I'll provide exact numbers, but the first draft of the numbers were about 4.95.
We'll get the real numbers.
Okay. We'll get real numbers.
All right. Thank you both very much for coming down today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, and I didn't mean to interrupt your...
No. Glad to have you.
But I did.
You did. We'll recess the public hearing on House Bill 43. Reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3129 with a reminder that brevity is the soul of, wit, but he's not in the legislature anymore. So let's bring up Peter Hanley and John McCulley.
Good morning, Chair Shetterly, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peter Hanley. I'm director of CASA of Oregon. We're a nonprofit based in Newburgh, Oregon, developing housing for Oregon's farm workers. I'm here to testify on 3129, opposing the provision for the elimination of the farm worker tax credits. There's an estimated 44,000 year-round farm workers in Oregon. During the peak growing season, there's 150,000 migrant and seasonal farm workers and their families. These workers are crucial to the $4 billion agricultural economy in this state. During our 15 years in business, we've constructed approximately 600 units of farm worker housing around the state. We've also rehabbed a number of labor camps for on-farm housing. We've developed single-family homes, homeownership training and counseling, and down-payment assistance to over 100 farm worker families. Many of these people have gone on to buy homes, and that's helped them realize the American dream that many of us have realized. Since the legislature established this tax credit in 89, we've been able to develop these farm worker housing units. Without this tax credit, many of these units would not be created. The credit has helped leverage over $30 million in private and federal funding, leveraging a factor of $12 for every dollar of tax credit. This existing credit functions very well with very little administrative costs to the state, to the owners of the housing, as well as to the tax credit investor. What this means is that it's an efficient and simple way to attract private investment capital where this capital would not normally go. The 2001 legislature wisely decided to eliminate the sunset on this credit after a report by the Interim Farm Worker Housing Task Force headed up by Representative Mannix and Senator Castillo. It had the broad support of the Farm Bureau, Nurserymen's Association, tree fruit growers, as well as others. This is a targeted tax credit that gets things done that won't normally get done. CASA would probably not be in business today if it were not for this credit, or we wouldn't be producing the 75 to 100 units of farm worker housing that we're able to produce. Of these 640 units that have been produced or rehabilitated, this is in-town housing. Half of these are owned by CDCs. The other half are owned by housing authorities. And I believe Phil Donovan today from the Association of Oregon Housing Authorities will address that part of it. I've included in my package a number of letters from those CDCs that we've assisted over the years. And some of these we have existing projects that we're developing now. We have projects. I also handed out a status report on the back page of the status report lists all of the locations in Oregon where we have developed housing. Front page lists projects currently under development. There are a couple projects that are not currently listed on here that we're examining sites in Independence, Monmouth, and as well as some sites outside of the Dalles. The replacing this credit with a standard charitable deduction would require some organizational changes from our standpoint. It would really turn us into a fundraising organization. And while we're raising funds for projects, it's coming from five sources, not 400 or 500 sources, as we would have to do under this. While it's a nice attempt to bring the consumer into this, it really isn't an efficient way for us to address this situation. And I think the legislature in the 99 session as well as the 2001 session understood that, and that's why they made this permanent and they increased the cap on it. The current cost of the state, at I think for 01, 03, was about $1 million. It's going to go up with the changes in the last legislature to a maximum of about $3 million per year would be the maximum impact that this would have. It would impose additional administrative costs to us that we really can't burden at this time for the development of this housing. Included in the package of the letters of testimony is one from the Department of Agriculture Rural Development from the director. It's on the second page. What he's indicating here is that without this leveraged funds, we probably wouldn't be very competitive for the limited federal funds that are directly for farm worker housing. And these funds would likely go to other states that have more, as he states, robust state programs where they have sufficient leveraged money. The other letters in here, as I stated earlier, are from the producers, the CDCs in the different communities that have produced and are owning and operating this housing. And with that, I'll conclude my comments and take any questions at this time.
All right, let's just go to Mr. McCulley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John McCulley. I'm here representing the tree fruit industry, which are the apple, pear, and cherry growers in Hood River, Wasco, Umatilla, and Jackson counties. I echo the statements made by Mr. Hanley. This is a very important tax credit on the grower side. The growers provide a significant amount of farm worker housing in the state, and have found that it is critical to attracting a quality workforce to have quality housing, whether it be in the community or on the farm. This tax credit has done what it was intended to do when it was established in 1985 or 89, when it was sunsetted and reenacted in 1995, and again when it was set permanently in 2001. It has improved the lives of farm workers. It has allowed producers to attract a quality workforce, and we think it deserves to be continued.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions? If not, thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Let me bring up three people next together to just save time in transition. You're not signed up together, but you all seem to have the same view on this bill, so to be comfortable. Balthazar Ortiz, Larry Perry, and Jack Kenny. And we'll take Mr. Ortiz first.
We should have coordinated.
Yeah.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Baltasar Ortiz. I am a business owner from Sandy, Oregon, and the founder of Hacienda CDC, which is a community development corporation. In this capacity, I've developed farm worker housing in Oregon, and I appreciate the opportunity to come before you to speak in opposition of House Bill 3129. I can tell you from firsthand experience that farm worker housing has many benefits. There will always be a need for farm worker housing in Oregon. They are critical to our economy. Farm workers are hardworking people who are trying to improve their conditions and lives. In reality, they're the engine that drives this $4 billion a year industry, the agricultural industry in Oregon. Often families are forced to live in separate quarters or in substandard conditions. This would disrupt the family's stability that is so important to their well-being and ability to reach their full potential. Inadequate housing can negatively affect education, health care, and other issues. conversely, there are tremendous benefits to having stable farm worker housing. While farm workers may transition into new careers or new locations, the housing provided can remain for new farm workers. It is a long-term investment in Oregon economy. Decent housing provides dignity and support to this key component of the economic base of these communities. The passage of House Bill 3129 would have a profound negative effect on our ability to assist farm workers in Oregon. I urge the legislature to continue its support of the economic base in our farm worker communities by preserving the farm worker housing tax credits that make possible stable housing for these that need it the most. As I said before, I can speak firsthand. From the age of 6 years old to the age of 17, I worked in concert with my family to support our being. The house tax credit was not available at that time, but I was able to break away from that cycle at the age of 17. And so I can speak firsthand as the necessity of this type of housing for these people to be able to better their lives. I could be an example of what can happen to a lot of people. Housing is the base for the ability to do this. If people cannot have housing to live as a family, as I said before, you know, many things can happen to deteriorate that family base. So I urge you, really, to look at this as to the people that will be affected by the elimination of this tax credit.
Thank you, Mr. Ortiz. Mr. Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Larry Perry, and I'm here representing Oregon Common Cause and to address the repeal of the political tax credit. It's hard to believe that people come before the Revenue Committee with special interests, as the original, as our first speaker said. But
shocks us every day.
I know. Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm familiar with somewhat with the Revenue Committee. Let's see. We oppose the repeal of the political tax credit. And as the committee knows, as it just mentioned, that tax deferrals, tax deductions, or tax credits are passed with the purpose in mind to encourage business, et cetera, promote alternative power sources. However, the one tax credit that exists here in the state of Oregon relates directly to the process of governing and the democratic decision-making, and that's the Oregon Political Tax Credit. Its use by Oregon citizens undoubtedly played a direct role in the people who are in electing the people who are sitting here, assembled here. The point is that, in fact, the Oregon Political Tax Credit is an intricate part of our governing process. It's we're presently taking part. People here are presently taking part in here because of that Oregon tax credit. Its purpose, as stated by the Department of Revenue, is to increase public participation by Oregonians at a time when we believe it's difficult to convince voters that they still have a relevant part in the process of electing office holders. The criticism of it is usually twofold over the past years, both in the reports by the Department of Revenue and otherwise. And the criticisms are usually that it appears to be used by a small percent of Oregon taxpayers, usage reportedly being only 5% of full-year resident filing tax forms, et cetera, and that it's used primarily by upper-income taxpayers. If you'll follow with me, you'll note that that data is not as it. You need to look at it more closely to know that the 5% should probably come closer to 10%, which is very significant in terms of the usage of a political tax credit. The tax expenditure reports that you have, 202-203, actually makes a reference to the year 2000. If you'll note, it says 5% of the taxpayers use this $50 credit, and it costs the state $4.97 million. It doesn't work out that way. Mathematically, that can't be, unless the administrative costs are horrendous, and I'm sure they're not. In fact, the minimum number of users of the $50 credit has to be over 100,000, 120,000. Is probably closer to the actual amount. If one adds to that, and that comes about primarily because in looking at the data, the tax forms are submitted in as single or joint filings. And many of the times the reports use the term resident, they are actually using the meaning filing. And so the numbers are not as they first seem to be. The point being made in part is that the tax credit does what it is supposed to have, what it was designed to do, to reach, to be used by middle-income taxpayers. The reason that the tax credit is successful is not hard to understand. Citizens get to choose the candidates and measures they wish to support. It fosters a positive, active role for citizens. It's very different from checkoff or add-on systems usually used by states or the federal government. Those are systems seen as a way to raise money for candidates rather than for citizen participation. In addition, it encourages a situation where contributors and candidates come together, and it creates a source of campaign money for potential candidates. Finally, let it be noted, if the U.S. Supreme Court is correct in its Buckley versus Vallejo decision that money for campaigns is equivalent to expressing free speech, the Oregon political tax credit provides a whisper of free speech, and that whisper should not be silenced by repealing a tax credit that's used by well over 100,000 Oregonians.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay. Mr. Kinney?
Thank you, Chair Scott, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jack Kenney. I'm Deputy Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. I think Mr. Hanley, Mr. McCulley, and Mr. Ortiz have made most of the points that I was going to make. I would just say from a technical standpoint, I'm here in opposition, to speak in opposition to House Bill 3129, and specifically in regards to the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit and the Farm Worker Lenders Credit. From a technical standpoint, I would like to say that the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit does work very well for the purpose that it was designed. If we didn't have, as I've said in my written testimony, if we did not have the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit, in order to maintain the production of this much-needed resource for our agricultural economy and for our farm workers, we would have to add additional grant funds, which are already vastly oversubscribed. Some sources of the grant funds just don't work as well, particularly with on-farm housing, as does the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit. So repeal or sunsetting of the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit would significantly reduce, as Mr. Hanley mentioned, our ability to provide farm worker housing in Oregon. And others have pointed out, providing decent housing has many social and economic benefits to the state. It also reduces the risk of legal actions against farmers and probably reduces the need for production of illegal farm camps. So I urge you to continue your support. As was also pointed out, the 2000 legislative session had the interim task force, which identified the high need for farm worker housing. I think that's verified. The program was transferred to our department in 2001. The Farm Worker Housing Tax Credits for 2002 were fully subscribed, so I think that substantiates the need and the effectiveness of the program. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next we have Mike Greening and Jeff Isnoff. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Mike Graney. I'm director of the Oregon Office of Energy, and I want to speak on Section 13 of House Bill 3129 that would repeal the business energy tax credit. We believe this tax credit is very valuable, and I'll be very brief because I think Joe Schweinhardt from Associated Oregon Industries covered most of the reasons. I just want to mention a couple of things. And I'm passing out two handouts, one that gives more details on the energy tax credits, including the business energy tax credit. Another that to remind the committee that, of the legislation that was passed in 2001, a key provision of which was passed by this committee to enhance the business energy tax credit to help us respond to the energy crisis we were in then. And the response of the legislature was to have a balanced response to both increase the energy supply through expedited power plant siting, but also to increase our efforts on conserving energy. And the business energy tax credit is the key program in that effort. As a result of the changes you made in 2001, business investment in energy conservation has doubled each of the last 2 years to over $100 million each year. It has helped businesses withstand the price shocks that we incurred that resulted in layoffs of many workers. It's helped businesses stay in business. It's also helped lower-income families in rental housing. The tax credit has helped weatherize over 47,000 rental units. Finally, I think the program is important, again, because of to help business stay in business, to help with the changes you also made last session. We've been able to work with schools who partner with businesses to reduce their operating costs or their energy costs and reduce their exposure to increased energy increasing rates. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Is that it?
No.
Oh, okay. All right.
Although I will not be long, my name is Jeff Bissonette. I'm here today representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. CUB represents residential ratepayers of utilities, electricity, natural gas, telecommunications. We have about 6,000 members around the state. One of the tough things about being sort of later in on the speaker's list is that
everything's
been said, but you haven't had a chance to say it, so I will be very brief. We join with the Office of Energy and others who have cautioned you about ending the energy tax credit,
the new hybrid.
Energy tax credit. Because we did recognize at the height of the energy crisis in the last session that that program was doing a lot of good work, could do even more good work, and has continued to do good work. It's important to realize from a consumer point of view that either as ratepayers or as taxpayers, you will pay the cost of higher energy prices, or you will pay probably a lesser cost over time of trying to conserve energy. It's a common phrase in the energy industry that the cheapest kilowatt is the kilowatt you don't have to produce in the first place, and that's precisely what the business energy tax credit does. And so from the perspective of residential ratepayers, we would urge you to look long and hard before you ended what is a very effective program and something that we really learned the value of at the height of the energy crisis, and continuation of that tax credit will probably help blunt or even prevent future energy crises. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer questions.
All right. There aren't any. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Next, let's have up, we can wind up the testimony on here, Libby Henry and Robin Freeman. And I don't want to telegraph anything here, but based on the Senate sheet, Representative Miller is the only person testifying in favor of this bill. So let that guide your But welcome. Thank you for waiting.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Libby Henry. I represent the Eugene Water and Electric Board. EWEB is a municipal utility that serves water and electricity to the citizens of Eugene. We also are here in support of continuing this program, and I'm going to talk very briefly just to give you some numbers of the value of this program to our customers. First of all, taking advantage of this program have been School District 4J.
Microphone over the teeth. There you go. Thank
taking
you.
Advantage of this program have been School District 4J, City of Eugene, Lane County, U of O, in addition to businesses in our community. We've spent $20 million in investments in this tax credit. So we've saved seven average megawatts, serves 4,100 homes, and saves our customers about $4 million. So the $4 million over time goes into the future, because this is always seven average megawatts that you don't have to purchase. When a company installs these conservation measures, the measures last from somewhere between 7 and 15 years. When they wear out and the company has to reinstall the measures, usually by that point technology has improved and the measures they install are even more efficient. So what would normally be a 15-year life of a measure would go into the future indefinitely. So what you have is seven average megawatts you never have to purchase and $4 million that increases in value every time your rates go up. And as you know, our rates are not going down. They're going up, and that savings goes indefinitely into the future. So this is a win-win for our community as a whole. And then finally, representing Eugene, I have to speak to the environmental benefits of this program. Anytime you offset the need for future generation because there are megawatts you don't have to produce, it's good for the environment and the air and everybody.
All right.
That's it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chairman Shetterly, members of the committee. My name is Robin Freeman, and I represent the Oregon People's Utility District Association. What I bring to you today are some letters and statements from three of my PUDs, and I have an email that you don't have from a fourth PUD, and they talk about the projects that are currently underway. If I could just direct your attention to the statement from Columbia River PUD. On the second page, they've got a table of developing energy efficiency projects that probably will not proceed without continuation of this tax credit, the energy tax credit. So we're here to support the business energy tax credit. And on that table, if you'll notice, there's a projected annual savings of $812 million, projected kilowatt savings of 14,368,000 kilowatts, and it's tied to local employees in Columbia County of 1,066. In number. Emerald PUD also has a similar graph available for you in the packet that I provided. And Clatskanie PUD would like you to know that they're currently involved in four projects, three with the Georgia Pacific Wanamill and one with their middle high school. The savings to the high school would be $30,000 annually in energy savings. And with that, that's all I have today, and thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Let's finish up with Bob Castagna and Don Schoenberg. Oh, I've got a couple more on. Let me bring up Mary Mann also. And Mary Mann, if you want to come on forward, I've got another sheet here. Oh, and Don's out of the room. So, okay, we have Don Schoenberg and Mary Mann. Matt, there's a chair at the table. Matt Blevins, come on up. And that's it. We're bringing up the drawbridge on House Bill 3129. So, last across. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bob Castagna representing the Oregon Catholic Conference. The Oregon Catholic Conference would like to go on record in opposition to eliminating tax credits related to farm worker housing construction and loans. We've heard testimony on this issue. I'm not going to belabor the point. We think this is a worthy credit that accomplishes a worthy social goal.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Ms. Mann?
Thank you. Chairperson, Representative Shetterly, and respected committee members, my name is Mary Mann. I'm a general contractor. I'm president of Goose Hollow Window Company. a member of the Metro Family Housing Council, the Oregon Apartment Association, the Oregon Remodelers Association. I sit on their Governmental Affairs Committee, and I also represent their interests here today, and the National Association of the Remodeling Industry. And in a past life, I was a community resources planner for an affiliate of United Way, and I have a pretty good understanding of how the contribution system works for charitable organizations. It is not an enviable position that you are in to find ways to pay the bills of this state. For now and for the future, I'm here to urge you to consider leaving the business energy tax credit alone and allow the benefits of the program to continue. The first line of benefits are to the investment property owner that need the extra financial help to upgrade properties where the effect of these energy improvements most immediately and directly benefit Oregon residents that have the least control over energy conservation and have the least disposable income to deal with energy costs. I am a landlord that has upgraded my own rental property. I'm a weatherization contractor that's done millions of dollars worth of weatherization work in the past 23 years and work with many property owners that have used the Betsy programs. The relationship between renters and landlord is very precarious. I cannot tell you how many owners have installed windows and insulated their rental properties while their own homes go wanting. They understand as business people how important it is to keep good tenants, and then in a demanding market of the late 90s and early 2000s, how hard it has been to keep new rental property rented, no less aging housing stock. Renters today are more sophisticated and demanding.
Ms. Mann, if I may, I'm sorry, but with 15 minutes before sure. 4, we've got your written testimony sure. here. It looks like you're going through, and I promise you on behalf of every member of the committee that we will read through to the very end of your written testimony. I apologize for cutting you off, but we're running out of time here today. Did you want to add anything that's not in your written testimony?
Well, one of the things that hasn't been brought up, it was touched on, was right now we're in a transition point for the deregulation of electricity, and we've watched PGE and Portland General Electric stop their ability to buy the pass-through, buy the tax credit from owners. And that's really put a big dent in the ability of investors to have liquidity, to have the cash to do this versus having a five-year tax credit. Right now, with the energy trust being in transition, we also see that a lot of these renters who have no political control are contributing 3% of their utility bills that will not be able to see the benefit of that money unless owners invest in these properties. And the only way they're going to do it now is to take advantage of the 35% tax credit. So it's a vicious cycle. If the tenants don't have a voice, the only way to get a voice is through the people that own the properties from whom they rent. And this gives them the voice.
Very good. I appreciate you adding that comment to your written testimony. Matt Blevins. We have your written testimony, too.
Great. Chair Sutterly, members of the committee, for the record, Matt Blevins, Legislative Affairs Director with the Oregon Environmental Council. I'll be brief. Again, this will be one of the few times that I think that OEC and AOI will come before you and agree completely on where we are. Hopefully it will be growing the number of times we see this. Again, this would be a boon to OEC because of being able to take advantage of a tax credit that could help contribute to charitable contributions. That would be a good thing, but in place of losing Betsy, that's not a good thing. We would oppose that, and we oppose the bill for that reason. Betsy's an example of tax credits that do good things, work for a broad number of people, get people to go above and beyond the law.
Okay.
So thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3129. Committee members, let me, and those of you in the audience, I'm looking here on HJR 43, and it looks to me like we pretty well have a lineup of witnesses who are folks either in the building on a regular basis or can be. I think I'm going to defer any further testimony on HJR 43 for today. What we heard today, obviously there's some amendments going to be required on that before we bring it back, so we will not be going back to HJR 43 today, so I'll close the public hearing on that as well. That'll leave us time to get to our community college bills because we've got some folks who traveled across the mountains to testify to us on that, and I want to make sure we catch their testimony. But before we do that, we're going to take about a two-minute work session on House Bill 3050, which I will open. My understanding, Mazin, unless you tell me otherwise, is that there are no amendments on that. Dennis Mulvihill is in the audience. Dennis had represented to me that he was interested in an amendment that I think he's going to try and catch on the Senate side. Is that correct, Dennis? So it didn't change. It was an add-on. It didn't actually change this bill. It was something in addition to this. Okay. So, and my advice to Dennis was, in the interest of time and moving out House bills, that we, since it doesn't really affect the substance of this, it's just something that would catch with the relating clause, that he can do that on the Senate. And so with that, I think we have 3050 ready to go with no amendments. Is that right, Masson?
That's correct.
And the other thing, for the record, I think Tom Gallagher, on behalf of the Newspaper Publishers Association, was in with his undecided testimony when we heard this, and that he's determined that the Newspaper Publisher Association is not opposed to the bill, so at that point there is no opposition on the bill. Yes. For the record.
Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
Representative Williams.
I move House Bill 3050 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves House Bill 3050 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Hearing none, please call the roll. Kathy.
Representative
Farr. Excuse.
Aye.
And we'll show Berger is excused as well. House Bill 3050 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do we have anyone who would like to carry that?
Okay.
Representative Berger. Thank you. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3050. And I'm going to open... request unanimous consent to temporarily return to work session on House Bill 3050 for the purpose of allowing Representative Farr to vote. Is there any objection? Hearing none. Representative Farr, how do you vote on 3050?
Aye.
Okay.
Good guess.
Good guess. Close the public the work session on 3050, and let me open together a public hearing on House Bill 3377 and House Bill 3399. We'll hear those together. And bring up, Steve, if you could give us a thumbnail sketch, and then we'll bring our folks in to testify on that.
Okay, both of those bills deal with the community college distribution of the community college support fund. 3377 says that the commissioner may not take into consideration property taxes in making that distribution, and then sets up a distribution such that 1% of the fund would be given to each of the community colleges, and so that would make up 17%. The other 83% would be distributed by FTE. House Bill 3399 basically says that the distribution formula shall take into consideration all local property taxes except local option property taxes.
Okay, thank you very much. I'll call up the witnesses that are signed up on these sheets, and again, you can testify to either or both. Some of you have signed up on both. Craig Smith and Bob Barber. Let's start two at a time here. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in. Sorry to keep you waiting, but appreciate your patience.
Mr. Chair, committee, my name is Craig Smith. I'm the Vice President and Chief Financial Officer at Chemeketa Community College, and I'm here today to speak on 3399. The last year or so have not been the most fun of times to be a college business officer. I realize that being a legislature has its challenges, but we have certainly gone through a lot of challenges in the last year in terms of raising tuition, eliminating programs that build up over the years that are dear to us, terminating employment of our friends and coworkers. And the passage of 3399 would force Chemeketa to go back and cut additional hundreds of thousands of dollars from our budget. But I'm here to tell you that our board voted 7-0 to support doing just that. That our board is in favor of 3399. Even though it costs us money, we think it's the principled thing to do. The real question boils down to, if we don't do that, is there a public policy reason why Columbia Gorge should get $382, which is what they levy for their property taxes for each student, while Chemeketa gets $964 for that same student? Is there a reason why Umpqua would get $576 per student, while Central Oregon would get $1,758 for that same student? Their decision is no, there is not a policy reason for that, based on where the money comes from. The people will tell you that, well, that money comes from us. It was based on support that we've had over the years. And I could go through and explain, you know, why we don't agree with any of those arguments, but in the interest of time, I think that what I'll do is just say we feel that's irrelevant. One of the other hats I wear is right across the street here is a professor in the Graduate School of Management at Willamette University. I teach tax planning and government finance. And one of the things that we look at, one of the very first classes, is we look at the different fees you pay to government. And we talk about fines, which obviously people understand. We talk about fees you pay for services. If you're owning a utility, we talk about taxes. And the distinguishing feature of that tax is that it goes in for the public good, and it is not, you do not receive services based on the amount of taxes that you pay. You receive services based on a public policy. And that's why our board has voted to support $33.99, even though it would cost us money. We could say, well, we had support, you know, historically we had support. That support was based on a day in time, and it actually was a day because some of the tax levies passed the same day as the property tax limitations. The legislature had to decide, well, what are we going to place in there? At what exists at 8 o'clock in the morning or at 8:05 in the afternoon? Kind of reminds me of the Groundhog movie that you might have seen. If we could take a day or one of our best days and freeze it in perpetuity, that might be great. But as we get further from that decade, and as other things happen, new colleges are formed that didn't even exist then, we think it's better public policy. If there is a difference between the funding that schools get, it's based on such things as small school factors, the students they serve, not based on where the income comes from. I think the other point that I'd like to make is that if one school pays more, because we're all related with K-12 and ESD, all came under the Measure 5 compression of the $5, that in the long run, if a community college is getting more, collecting more on property tax, it means that the state is putting in more on the ESD or the K-12 because of the compression of 5. So we would urge you, if you are going to take action, that you would endorse $33.99. I also realize that this is something new that's been brought to the legislature for the first time this session, and if you choose not to take any action at this time, we would ask possibly that you might have some members of your committee that would help us facilitate and come back to you with something in a couple years that would resolve this for us.
Thank you, Craig Smith. President Barber, welcome back. You're going to give us the other side of the equation.
Chairman Charlie, thank you. I think I can do it in five statements. Specifically addressing House Bill 3399, as you know, I was here testifying in favor of removing the property tax at the 50% level. This particular legislation moves all of the property tax into the formula. I think moving 100% of the property tax in the formula moves us to a de facto state system. All of the funding would flow through the state. There's no statutory support for this move, in my opinion and others' opinions. It circumvents ORS 341. And I won't go through all the chapters and verses of 341, which really speaks to local control. There has been a formula in place for 45 years. The first 30 was directed by the legislature, the next 15 by the state, and only in the last six, based upon a vote of the majority of presidents, factored in property taxes. Prior to that, the other 39 years, property taxes was never taken into consideration. There's no statute or legislation or state board policy defining, promoting, or requiring this shift away from local control. Local community college planning is used to be responsive to their communities. Now we are forced to be responsive to a state-controlled formula designed by a majority of presidents. To approve this legislation would effectively, under the current formula, turn us into a state two-year junior college, trying to follow the vagaries of a formula and not trying to follow the needs and direction of our communities. We believe to approve this legislation would require a total reexamination of ORS 341 and whether we could, in fact, even follow the legislation as it currently exists if all of the local dollars were moved into the state coffers. I ask you not to approve this legislation and seek continued support. Your support to remove property taxes and return to the true intent of ORS 341. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you both. Paul,
thank
if
you.
I could ask if we could maybe check with him, let's see if we'd be excused from opening ceremonies anyway. We've only got three more witnesses to go on these two bills, and I'll call them all up together and then we'll wrap up for the morning. Richard Levine, Steve Cradlebaugh, and Cam Preuss Frawley. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for waiting. Sorry to put you at the end. We have a lot to accommodate today. But appreciate you being here. Mr. Cradlebaugh, do you want to go first?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve Cradlebaugh. I'm the president of Southwestern Oregon Community College in Coos Bay, Oregon. I'm testifying in favor of House Bill 3377. For the following reasons. One, it provides a more stable base for all the community colleges to operate off of. It removes the colleges depending upon the FTE as a significant, the largest significant funding element for our formula. And I'd like to talk to you a little bit about what's happened. There are four bills before the legislature this year dealing with community college funding and two dealing with governance. I think you asked what's going on, and I'm here to tell you that there is a huge sense of frustration amongst a significant number of presidents and their board members about what's going on in our system. I think the frustration evolves around one of stability. An example of this is in September of last year, 14 community college presidents voted in favor of supporting a funding formula that under the dire circumstances that this state has found itself in for the past 14 months, some stability to our system. That funding formula was taken to the State Board of Education, and it was changed such that the differences that you see on those numbers that I provided for you on the table became larger instead of all grouping around 14% decrease for comparison from this coming year funding for 2 years ago and for coming year's funding for this next year. I'm probably the minority of the presidents. I welcome your intrusion into our funding formula. I hope that if you do establish a committee to take a look at our funding formula, you do have representation from our boards, from our presidents, from the CCWD and the State Board of Education. But I also encourage you to have significant representation from intelligent, well-meaning, and thoughtful Oregonians to take a look at how our system should be funded, because there is no stability in our system. It has been driven by FTE, and if you do not get more and more FTE, you lose more and more money. Now, you couple that with a stable or declining funding source, and there are some schools that are in big trouble. So that's that bill. I'm opposed to House Bill 3399.
For the same reason you favor 3377.
Yes, I am. Right. Let me talk about that a little bit. I had some prepared remarks, but I'm going to talk a little bit about some things I've heard earlier today. Representative Merkley and Senator Harper talked about stability. We don't have stability in our funding formula. We also don't have local control. 50% of that has been taken away. I ask you, did local control just become an issue, or was it an issue up until November of 1990 with ballot measure 5? Local control has always been an important element for Oregonians. Prior to 1990, the people in my district voted to fund Southwestern Oregon Community College at a far richer rate than the other community colleges in the state. We had the second highest millage rate and still do in the state. That has been taken away from us because nine community college presidents back in 1995, continued to vote to include 50% of local property taxes in the funding formula based upon equity. My voters in my district up until 1990 had said, our equity is that we will tax ourselves at a greater rate to provide our programs to our citizens and our youth. Now that's becoming another issue within the legislature because of the funding crisis we're all in. The local option is as valid in the future as it was in the past, And I think that those local property taxes belong to the districts that pass them. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, Chairperson Shetterly, members of the committee, my name is Richard Levine. I'm the president at Rogue Community College in Southern Oregon. I will be very brief. I stand in opposition to 3399, and I'm in favor of 3377. Amazing. Let me just a couple of comments.
We should have handed out uniforms at the beginning of the
We actually do have uniforms, probably. The issue for Rogue Community College over the last six years has been a loss of approximately $8 million in our local property taxes that goes to other colleges. That wouldn't be as terrible as it seems if, in fact, our tuition differential between the college, Rogue Community College, and the colleges that are receiving property taxes wasn't an average of $10 per credit. Up until the five special sessions and the governor's budget, most of the colleges who were receiving property tax relief, and I'll categorize it at that, had very low tuition rates compared to those colleges who are actually having to contribute a share of their state dollars through the property tax formula. So until this year, we were literally the most expensive community college in the state of Oregon. This year we're at $49. Next year, with fees, we will be at $67 per credit. Portland will be at about $58 a credit. Those are the two opposite, the polar opposites in this issue. We lose another $1.2 million next year, another $1.3 million after that, and it goes up and up. Conversely, Portland will wind up with more and more money. As this formula continues to go out, there are very few community colleges who will benefit from the current formula, because the current formula was based on the legislature allocating more dollars for community colleges as our enrollments grow. This was, in reality, an enrollment formula. And most of the presidents who were around at the time who agreed to the formula realized that we were giving up some of our property taxes in exchange at that time for talking to the legislature about more money because of our ever-increasing enrollments. It's a very simple process in which now we find ourselves in just a 180-degree turn in which revenues are short, our colleges are still growing, and we have a formula that doesn't really fit the current situation. And one more thing in closing. No matter what change you have in the formula, and this is a frustration of community college presidents, there are winners and losers. So when you look at this particular bill, 3377, it is going to disadvantage schools who benefit from receiving property taxes. If you look at any change in the formula, there are going to be winners and losers. There isn't any way around that because we are so different. Thank you.
Ms. Price Brawley, it looks like the sheriff has just come to arrest the committee. If you could be about 30 seconds or less, before we get hauled away in chains.
I could. For the record, Cam Price Brawley, the Commissioner of Community Colleges. I think that the last weekend, this week, is a display of the dilemma that we are in. There is not agreement. There is wide disagreement about any funding formula. I said that when you met last week. If there was a perfect formula, we would have adopted it. I do want to remind the committee that we do have a committee of the presidents and the state board that is working on a new formula for the future. The formula that has gotten us to the place where we seem to be at each other's throats has been suspended. It is in frozen animation while we produce something new. So I would ask for your patience while we attempt to define as perfect a formula as we can and see these bills as hindering us from using all the factors that we would have available to us to form that next perfect formula, not perfect storm. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I think we've, from these bills and what we heard last week, this is our first legislative peek, I think, inside the tent. My inclination, committee, rather than moving any of these bills that are before us and just taking aside, would be at least to work with the stakeholders and propose some legislative participation and some work group effort. We're from the government. We're here to help. and see if we can at least by that offer some legislative input and perhaps provide some new dynamic into the discussion. And I'll work with representatives of the stakeholders and see if we can't, not to undo or work against what you're doing, but we obviously have an interest in this. Constituent colleges and constituent college presidents that have concerns on both sides of this thing, and so I think we've got an interest in trying to get this resolved as well. I'm a little reluctant to just pick a door and go there on the short time that we've seen this argued in front of us, but I think clearly it's something we're going to want to get involved in. And we've done some good work with ESDs, with special ed, and we've helped some situations that seemed intractable. Sometimes we want to make it worse, but in this case, I don't think we can. So, having said that, I want to thank everybody again for their patience. And Todd, thank you for your patience. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3377 and House Bill 3399, and we're not done with this. We will continue the discussions, but for today, we are adjourned.